The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli. An Adult Brain audiobook production. Read by Graham Dunlop. A note on the translation. In this translation, I have sought to be as literal and exact as is consistent with readable English, since I am convinced that Machiavelli was one of the greatest and subtlest minds to whom we have access. I take very seriously the translator's obligation to present a writer's thought in his own words, insofar as possible. It did not seem to me my duty, therefore, to find a rough equivalent to Machiavelli's words in up-to-date colloquial prose, and to avoid cognates at all costs. For example, I am not embarrassed to translate provincia, province, and patria, fatherland, because these English words are perfectly intelligible, even though they are not the expressions we would use today. It is worthwhile trying to retain the connotations of those words as Machiavelli used them, as well as trying to avoid the connotations of their modern equivalents, such as nation. With this intent in translation, I've tried to retain some flavor of Machiavelli's style by preserving his favorite expressions and some of his crowded sentences and difficult grammar. If the result seemed a little old-fashioned, so it should. Machiavelli's text will live without our help, and it will die if we suffocate it with the sort of hospitality that allows it to live with us only on our terms. As to exactness, I would have liked never to vary the translation of such important words as impressa, modo, and rispetto, but I have found it impossible to produce a readable version with such a rule. I have kept virtue as virtue, so that readers of this translation can follow and join the dispute over the meaning Machiavelli attaches to the word. If his use of it sounds strange, as it did when he wrote and still does today, then let the reader wonder at finding something strange. It is not the translator's business to make everything familiar. For some of my departures from consistency, I have noted the literal meaning in the notes. I have surely not varied the translation merely for the sake of elegance. We should not be so certain that we know what Machiavelli's key terms or concepts are. Frequently, he will use a word or phrase several times in close proximity, and such density of usage can alert us to the importance of that word in that context. His pronouns are often ambiguous in their reference, and I've sometimes had to make a choice that he leaves open. I have indicated in the notes the occasions on which Machiavelli departs from his usual familiar you and addresses a formal or plural you, a you who is asked to see, consider, or think something. In the spirit of accuracy, I have not provided long historical notes to explain Machiavelli's examples. The Prince is not a history book. It was written, we believe, in 1513, and it was dedicated, we know, to Lorenzo de' Medici. But it was written for the future and addressed above all others, including Lorenzo, to whoever understands it. This does not mean that readers who want to understand the Prince can ignore Machiavelli's examples and merely make a list of his sensational assertions. On the contrary, those assertions are always modified, sometimes even contradicted, by the examples. But the examples will not serve as examples if the reader does not look carefully at the information Machiavelli gives him. He may miss the point if he allows this information to be superseded by the superior historical knowledge of our day. The text of The Prince has many variations arising from the facts that no original manuscript in Machiavelli's hand exists, and that the work was not published in his lifetime under his supervision. Those who want to examine the philological scholarship seeking to establish an authoritative text should begin with the article of Quaglio, listed in the biography. I have followed the text of Casella for the most part, adopting some variants where they seemed appropriate. Such are the principles of this translation. I have profited from other translations, especially from that of Leo Paul S. de Alvarez. If the reader thinks my translation a bad one, let him try his own. If he thinks it good, let him learn Italian. Chronology. 1469, May 3rd. Niccolo Machiavelli, N.M., from here on. Born in Florence, son of Bernardo, October, Ferdinand, heir to Aragon, marries Isabella, heir to Castile, December, Death of Piero de' Medici, 1476, Niccolo at school. 1478, Pazzi conspiracy in which Giuliano is killed in the cathedral and Lorenzo escapes, becoming the dominant figure in Florence. 1482, Savonarola begins to preach in Florence. 1483, death of Louis XI, King of France. Charles VIII succeeds at age 13. 1491, marriage of Charles VIII with Anne of Brittany, effectively the unification of France. 1492, taking of Granada by Ferdinand, effectively the unification of Spain. April 8th, death of Lorenzo de' Medici, Lorenzo the Magnificent, succeeded by his son Piero. August 11th, Rodrigo Borgia, becomes Pope, takes name of Alexander VI. 1494, King Charles VIII of France invades Italy, the Medici expelled from Florence. Savonarola gains authority there. 1498, April 8th, death of Charles VIII, succeeded by Louis XII. May 23rd, Savonarola, excommunicated and burned at the stake in the Piazza della Signora in Florence. N.M. put at head of Second Chancery of the Florentine Republic, also secretary to the Ten of War. Caesar Borgia, son of Pope Alexander VI, made Duke of the Valentinois, Duke Valentino. 1499, mission of N.M. to Forli. August to October, army of Louis XII enters Italy, captures Milan. September 28th, Paolo Vitelli, condottiere for Florence, led to Florence and beheaded. 1500, February 5th, Ludovico Sforza, Il Moro, retakes Milan from the French. April 10th, French retake Milan and imprison Ludovico. June and July, N.M. at the Florentine siege of Pisa. August 7th to December, N.M. on mission to court of France, meeting Louis XII and Georges d'Amboise, Cardinal of Rouen. 1501, February 2nd, N.M. at Pistoia. Caesar Borgia named Duke of Romagna by his father. August 18, N.M. in Siena with its lord Pandolfo Petrucci. N.M. marries Marietta Corsini. 1502, N.M. on missions to Caesar Borgia in Romagna. December 31st, Caesar has Vitellozzo, brother of Paolo Vitelli, and Oliveretto strangled at Sinigaglia. 1503, August 18th, death of Alexander VI. October 23rd to December 18th, N.M. on mission to Rome. November 1st, Julius II created Pope. He then forces Caesar Borgia to give over his conquest to the church. 1504, N.M. again sent to France, writes the first Decanal, a poem on events in Italy since 1494. 1505, N.M. sent on missions to Perugia, Mantua, Siena, begins on plan for militia in Florence. 1506, N.M. sent to Julius II, follows him in his expedition to the Romagna. September 13th, N.M. with Julius II as he enters Perugia, ruled by Baglioni. 1507, N.M. on mission to court of Emperor Maximilian. Caesar Borgia dies. 1508, February, N.M. at the siege of Pisa. 1509, M.M. again in France and Siena. 1511, October 4th, Pope Julius forms Holy League to resist France. 1512, April 11th, Battle of Ravenna, won by France, but its general, Gaston de Foix, killed. August 31st, Piero Soderini overthrown. Florentine Republic ends. Medici family returns to power. November 7th, N.M. expelled from his position. 1513, February 19th, N.M. suspected of conspiracy against the Medici. He is arrested, imprisoned, and tortured. February 21st, death of Pope Julius II, succeeded by Giovanni de' Medici, Pope Leo X. March 13th, N.M. freed, exiled to his country home in Sant'Andrea, in Procosina, south of Florence. December 10th, N.M. writes to his friend Francesco Vettori that he has completed the prince. He also begins writing his discourses on Livy. 1515, January 1st, Death of Louis XII, Francis I succeeds. 1516, January 23rd, death of Ferdinand of Aragon, Charles V succeeds. 1517, N.M. writes The Golden Ass, an unfinished poem. Frequents the Orti Oricellari, gardens owned by his friend Cosimo Rucellai, for philosophical discussions. 1518, N.M. writes his comedy, The Mandragola. 1520, N.M. writes The Life of Castruccio, Castracani, is commissioned by Cardinal Giulio de' Medici to write the Florentine histories. 1521, publication of N.M.'s The Art of War. 1522, Cardinal Giulio de' Medici succeeds to papacy as Clement VII. 1525, N.M. in Rome presents the Florentine histories to Clement VII. 1527, Rome sacked by Emperor Charles V. June 21st, death of Machiavelli, buried in the Church of Santa Croce in Florence. 1531, first edition published of N.M.'s Discourses on Livy, with papal privilege. 1532, first edition published of N.M.'s The Prince, also with papal privilege. Dedicatory letter. Niccolo Machiavelli to the magnificent Lorenzo de' Medici. It is customary most of the time for those who desire to acquire favor with a prince to come to meet him with things that they care most for, among their own, or with things that they see please him most. Thus one sees them many times being presented with horses, arms, cloth of gold, precious stones, and similar ornaments worthy of their greatness. Thus, since I desire to offer myself to your magnificence with some testimony of my homage to you, I have found nothing in my belongings that I care so much for and esteem so greatly as the knowledge of the actions of great men, learned by me from long experience with modern things and a continuous reading of ancient ones. Having thought out and examined these things with great diligence for a long time, and now reduced them to one small volume, I send it to your magnificence. And although I judge this work undeserving of your presence, yet I have much confidence that through your humanity it may be accepted, considering that no greater gift could be made by me than to give you the capacity to be able to understand in a very short time all that I have learned and understood in so many years, and with so many hardships and dangers for myself. I have not ornamented this work, nor filled it with fulsome phrases, nor with pompous and magnificent words, nor with any blandishment or superfluous ornament whatever, with which it is customary for many to describe and adorn their things. For I wanted it either not to be honored for anything, or to please solely for the variety of the matter and the gravity of the subject. Nor do I want it to be reputed presumption if a man from a low and mean state dares to discuss and give rules for the governments of princes. For just as those who sketch landscapes place themselves down in the plain to consider the nature of mountains and high places, and to consider the nature of low places place themselves high atop mountains, similarly, to know well the nature of peoples one needs to be prince, and to know well the natures of princes one needs to be of the people. Therefore, your magnificence, take this small gift in the spirit with which I send it. If your magnificence considers and reads it diligently, you will learn from it my extreme desire that you arrive at the greatness that fortune and your other qualities promise you. And if your magnificence will at some time turn your eyes from the summit of your height to these low places, you will learn how undeservedly I endure a great and continuous malignity of fortune. Of Principalities. 1. How many are the kinds of principalities, and in what modes they are acquired? All states, all dominions that have held and do hold empire over men, have been and are either republics or principalities. The principalities are either hereditary, in which the bloodline of their lord has been their prince for a long time, or they are new, The new ones are either altogether new, as was Milan to Francesco Sforza, or they are like members added to the hereditary state of the prince who acquires them, as is the Kingdom of Naples to the King of Spain. Dominions so acquired are either accustomed to living under a prince or used to being free, and they are acquired either with the arms of others or with one's own, either by fortune or by virtue. 2. Of hereditary principalities. I shall leave out reasoning on republics because I have reasoned on them at length another time. I shall address myself only to the principality and shall proceed by weaving together the threads mentioned above, and I shall debate how these principalities may be governed and maintained. I say then that in hereditary states accustomed to the bloodline of their prince, the difficulties in maintaining them are much less than in the new states, because it is enough not only to depart from the order of his ancestors, and then to temporize in the face of accidents. In this way, if such a prince is of ordinary industry, he will always maintain himself in his state unless there is an extraordinary and excessive force which deprives him of it. And should he be deprived of it, if any mishap whatever befalls the occupier, he reacquires it. We have in Italy, for example, the Duke of Ferrara, who for no other cause than that his line was ancient in that dominion, did not succumb to the attacks of the Venetians in 84, nor to those of Pope Julius in 10. For the natural prince has less cause and less necessity to offend. Hence it is fitting that he be more loved, and if extraordinary vices do not make him hated, it is reasonable that he will naturally have the goodwill of his own. In the antiquity and continuity of the dominion, the memories and causes of innovations are eliminated, for one change always leaves a dentation for the building of another. 3. Of mixed principalities. But the difficulties reside in the new principality first, if it is not altogether new, but like an added member, so that, taken as a whole, it can be called almost mixed. Its instability arises in the first place from a natural difficulty that exists in all new principalities. This is that men willingly change their lords in the belief that they will fare better. This belief makes them take up arms against him, in which they are deceived because they see later by experience that they have done worse. That follows from another natural and ordinary necessity which requires that one must always offend those over whom he becomes a new prince, both with men-at-arms and with infinite other injuries that the new acquisition brings in its wake. So you have as enemies all those whom you have offered in seizing that principality. And you cannot keep as friends those who have put you there because you cannot satisfy them in the mode they had presumed, and because you cannot use strong medicines against them, since you are obliged to them. For even though one may have the strongest of armies, he always needs the support of the inhabitants of a province in order to enter it. Through these causes, Louis XII of France quickly occupied Milan and quickly lost it. And Ludovico's own forces were enough to take it from him the first time. For those people which had opened the gates to him, finding themselves deceived in their opinion in that future good they had presumed for themselves, were unable to tolerate the vexations of the new prince. It is indeed true that when countries that have rebelled are later acquired for the second time, they are lost with more difficulty, because the lord, seizing the opportunity offered by the rebellion, is less hesitant to secure himself by punishing offenders, exposing suspects, and providing for himself in the weakest spots. So it was that if one Duke Ludovico stirring up a commotion at the borders was enough to make France lose Milan the first time, to make him then lose it the second time, the whole world had to be against him, and his armies eliminated or chased from Italy. This arises from the causes given above. Nonetheless, both the first and the second times it was taken from him. The universal causes of the first have been discussed. It remains now to say what were the causes of the second, and to see what remedies there were to him which someone in his situation could use, so as to maintain himself better in his acquisition than France did. Now I say that such states which, when acquired, are added to an ancient state of him who acquires them, are either of the same province and same language or not. When they are, they may be held with great ease, especially if they are not used to living free, and to possess them securely it is enough to have eliminated the line of the prince whose dominions they were. For when their old conditions are maintained for them in other things, and there is no disparity of customs, men live quietly. As it may be seen that Burgundy, Brittany, Gascony, and Normandy, which have been with France for so long a time, have done. And although there may be some disparity of language, nonetheless the customs are similar, and they can easily bear with one another. And whoever acquires them, if he wants to hold them, must have two concerns. One, that the bloodline of their ancient prince be eliminated. The other, not to alter either their laws or their taxes, so that in a very short time it becomes one whole body with their ancient principality. But when one acquires states in a province disparate in language, customs, and orders, here are the difficulties, and here one needs to have great fortune and great industry to hold them. And one of the greatest and quickest remedies would be for whoever acquires it to go there to live in person. This would make that possession more secure and more lasting, as the Turk has done in Greece. Despite all the other orders observed by him so as to hold that state, if he had not gone there to live, it would not have been possible for him to hold it. For if you stay there, disorders may be seen as they arise, and you can soon remedy them. If you are not there, disorders become understood when they are great, and there is no longer a remedy. Besides this, the province is not despoiled by your officials. The subjects are satisfied with ready access to the prince, so that they have more cause to love him if they want to be good, and if they want to be otherwise, more cause to fear him. Whatever outsider might want to attack that state has more hesitation in doing so. Hence, when one lives in it, one can lose it with the greatest difficulty. The other, better remedy is to send colonies that are, as it were, fetters of that state, to one or two places, because it is necessary either to do this or to hold them with many men at arms and infantry. One does not spend much on colonies and without expense of one's own, or with little, one may send them and hold them. And one offends only those from whom one takes fields and houses in order to give them to new inhabitants, who are a very small part of that state. And those whom he offends, since they remain dispersed and poor, can never harm him, while all the others remain on the one hand unhurt, and for this they should be quiet. On the other, they are afraid to err from fear that what happened to the despoiled might happen to them. I conclude that such colonies are not costly and more faithful and less offensive. And those who are offended can do no harm since they are poor and dispersed as was said. For this has to be noted, that men should either be caressed or eliminated because they avenge themselves for slight offenses but cannot do so for grave ones. So the offense one does to a man should be such that one does not fear revenge for it. But when one holds a state with men-at-arms in place of colonies, one spends much more since one has to consume all the income of that state in guarding it. So the acquisition turns to loss, and one offends much more because one harms the whole state as one's army moves around for lodgings. Everyone feels this hardship, and each becomes one's enemy. And these are enemies that can harm one since they remain, though defeated, in their homes. From every side, therefore, keeping guard in this way is as useless as keeping guard by means of colonies is useful. Whoever is in a province that is disparate, as was said, should also make himself head and defender of the neighboring lesser powers and contrive to weaken the powerful in that province and to take care that, through some accident, a foreigner as powerful as he does not enter there. And it will always turn out that a foreigner will be brought in by those in the province who are malcontent, either because of too much ambition or out of fear, as once the Aetolians were seen to bring the Romans into Greece, and in every other province they entered, they were brought in by its inhabitants. And the order of things is such that as soon as a powerful foreigner enters a province, all those in it who are less powerful adhere to him, moved by the envy they have against whosoever has held power over them. So with respect to these lesser powers, he has no trouble in gaining them, because altogether they quickly and willingly make one mass with the state that he has acquired there. He has only to worry that these lesser powers may get too much force and too much authority, and with his forces and their support he can easily put down those who are powerful, so as to remain arbiter of that province in everything. And whoever does not conduct this policy well will soon lose what he has acquired, and while he holds it will have infinite difficulties and vexations within it. The Romans observed these policies well in their provinces they took. They sent out colonies, indulged the lesser powers without increasing their power, put down the powerful, and did not allow foreign powers to gain reputation there. And I want the province of Greece alone to suffice as an example. The Achaeans and the Aetolians were indulged by the Romans. The kingdom of the Macedonians was brought down, and Antiochus was chased out. Nor did the merits of the Achaeans or those of the Aetolians make the Romans permit them to increase any state of theirs. Nor did the persuasions of Philip ever induce them to be his friends without putting him down. Nor could the power of Antiochus make them consent to his holding any state in that province. For the Romans did in these cases what all wise princes should do. They not only have to regard for present troubles, but also for future ones. And they have to avoid these with all their industry, because when one foresees from afar, one can easily find a remedy for them, but when you wait until they come close to you, the medicine is not in time, because the disease has become incurable. And it happens with this, as the physicians say, of consumption, that in the beginning of the illness it is easy to cure and difficult to recognize. But in the progress of time, when it has not been recognized and treated in the beginning, it becomes easy to recognize and difficult to cure. So it happens in affairs of state, because when one recognizes from afar the evils that arise in a state, which is not given but to one who is prudent, they are soon healed. But when they are left to grow because they were not recognized, to the point that everyone recognizes them, there is no longer any remedy for them. Thus, the Romans, seeing inconveniences from afar, always found remedies for them and never allowed them to continue so as to escape a war, because they knew that war may not be avoided but is deferred to take advantage of others. So they decided to make war with Philip and Antiochus in Greece, in order not to have to do so in Italy. And they could have avoided both one and the other for a time, but they did not want to. Nor did that saying ever please them, which is every day in the mouths of the wise men of our times, to enjoy the benefit of time, but rather they enjoyed the benefit of their virtue and prudence. For time sweeps everything before it, and can bring with it good as well as evil, and evil as well as good. But let us return to France and examine whether he has done any of the things spoken of. I will speak of Louis and not of Charles, as the steps of the former, because he held his possession in Italy longer, may be seen better. And you will see that he did the contrary of the things that should be done to hold a state in a disparate province. King Louis was brought into Italy by the ambition of the Venetians, who wanted to gain half the state of Lombardy for themselves by his coming. I do not want to blame the course adopted by the king, for since he wanted to begin by gaining a foothold in Italy, and having no friends in this province, indeed, having all doors closed to him because of the conduct of King Charles, he was forced to take whatever friendships he could get. And having firmly adopted this course, he would have succeeded if, in managing other things, he had not made some error. Thus, when he had acquired Lombardy, the king regained quickly the reputation that Charles had taken from him. Genoa yielded, and the Florentines became his friends, the Marquis of Mantua, Duke of Ferrara, Bentivoglio, Madonna of Forli, the lords of Faenza, of Pizarro, of Rimini, of Camerino, of Piombino, the Lutens, Pisans, and Sienese. Everyone came to meet him so as to become his friend. And then the Venetians could consider the temerity of the course they had adopted. To acquire two lands in Lombardy, they made the king lord of 2/3 of Italy. One may now consider with how little difficulty the king could have maintained his reputation in Italy if he had observed the rules written above and had held secure and defended all those friends of his, who, because they were a great number, weak and fearful, some of the church, some of the Venetians, were always under a necessity to stay with him, and by their means he could always have secured himself easily against whoever remained great among us. But no sooner was he in Milan than he did the contrary by giving aid to Pope Alexander so that the Pope might seize the Romagna. Nor did he notice that with this decision he was weakening himself, stripping himself of his friends and those who had jumped into his lap, while making the church great by adding so much temporal greatness to the spiritual one that gives it so much authority. And having made the first error, he was compelled to continue, so that to put an end to the ambition of Alexander and to prevent his becoming lord of Tuscany, he was compelled to come into Italy. It was not enough for him to have made the church great and to have stripped himself of his friends, but because he wanted the kingdom of Naples, he divided it with the king of Spain. Whereas at first he was the arbiter of Italy, he brought in a companion so that the ambitious ones in that province and those malcontent with him had somewhere to turn. And whereas he could have left in that kingdom a king who was his pensioner, he threw him out so as to bring in one who could expel him. And truly, it is a very natural and ordinary thing to desire to acquire, and always, when men do it who can, they will be praised or not blamed. But when they cannot and wish to do it anyway, here lie the error and the blame. Thus, if France could have attacked Naples with his own forces, he should have done so. If he could not, he should not have divided Naples. And if the division of Lombardy he made with the Venetians deserves excuse because with it France gained a foothold in Italy, this other one deserves blame because it was not excused by that necessity. So then Louis had made these five errors. He had eliminated the lesser powers, increased the power of a power in Italy, brought in a very powerful foreigner, did not come to live there, did not put colonies there. Yet if he had lived, these errors could not have hurt him if he had not made a sixth, depriving the Venetians of their state. For if he had not made the church great or brought Spain into Italy, it would indeed have been reasonable and necessary to put down the Venetians. But when he had adopted these courses first, he should never have consented to their ruin. For while they were powerful, they would always have kept others away from a campaign in Lombardy, whether it was because the Venetians would not have consented to them unless they themselves were to become its lords, or because the others would not have wanted to take Lombardy from France in order to give it to the Venetians, and they would not have had the spirit to go and attack both of them. And if someone should say, King Louis ceded Romagna to Alexander and the kingdom to Spain to avoid a war, I reply with the reasons given above, that a disorder should never be allowed to continue so as to avoid a war, because that is not to avoid it, but to defer it to your disadvantage. And if some others should cite the faith that the king had pledged to the Pope to undertake that enterprise for him in return for dissolving his marriage and for the hat of Rouen, I reply that what I will say below on the faith of princes and how it should be observed. Thus, King Louis lost Lombardy for not having observed any of the conditions observed by others who have taken provinces and wish to hold them. Nor is this any miracle, but very ordinary and reasonable. And I spoke of this matter at Nantes with Rouen when Valentino, for so Caesar Borgia, son of Pope Alexander, was called by the people, was occupying Romagna. For when the Cardinal of Rouen said to me that the Italians do not understand war, I replied to him that the French do not understand the state, because if they understood, they would not have let the church come to such greatness. And it may be seen from experience that the greatness in Italy of the church and of Spain has been caused by France, and France's ruin caused by them. From this one may draw a general rule that never or rarely fails. Whoever is the cause of someone's becoming powerful is ruined, for that power has been caused by him either with industry or with force, and both the one and the other of these two are suspect to whoever has become powerful. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.